Central Time, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what's behind the rise in Lyme disease in Wisconsin? We'll take a closer look at what the research shows coming up shortly. Now it's time for our weekly check-in on the latest in national politics. Over the last week, it's been up in the air whether or not the United States will meet with North Korea to negotiate denuclearization. It seemed as though the original summit was called off, but a top-ranking North Korean diplomat is now apparently en route to the U.S. We'll break all of that down in a minute and take your calls about the North Korean summit at 800-642-1234. Do you think it will happen? Are you hopeful that negotiations will work and there will be a summit? Do you think it should be a top priority for the Trump administration and their diplomatic efforts? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Also, the midterm elections are heating up. There are a few crucial Senate seats that could swing the balance of partisan power, and President Trump is on the campaign trail to stump for GOP candidates. Later, we'll get an update on the Russia investigation and hear about the president's reaction to ABC's cancellation of Roseanne. Callum Borchers is a reporter covering the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. Callum, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be back.
Let's start with some domestic politics. President Trump is on the campaign trail to stump for GOP candidates that are coming up in the midterm elections. He was at a campaign rally in Tennessee yesterday for Senate candidate Marsha Blackburn. She's currently serving in the House and is being challenged by former mayor and governor Phil Bredesen. First, why is this Tennessee race so significant?
Well, it's significant because it's remarkable. The Democrats think they have a shot to win in that state at all. This is, of course, a deep red state that ought to be a reliable win for Republicans. And that does not appear to be the case right now. Blackburn has the edge in many polls, but it is hardly the slam dunk that one might expect. And so the mere fact that the president felt compelled to go to Tennessee to campaign on her behalf is notable.
Let's take a listen to President Trump at a rally yesterday talking about Blackburn's rival.
So Marsha's very liberal Democrat opponent, Phil Bredesen. I never heard of this guy. Who is he? Who is he? He's an absolute total tool of Chuck Schumer. He's a tool of Chuck Schumer, and of course, the MS-13 lover, Nancy Pelosi.
So, Callum, this sort of campaigning has worked well for President Trump in the past. What does he hope to accomplish with statements like that? Pretty inflammatory statements.
They are. And if you notice, there's sort of a fundamental inconsistency there that I'm sure he's hoping that listeners won't pick up on, which is one, he says he's never even heard of this guy, suggesting I don't know anything about him. But oh, by the way, I can tell you that he is a tool of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And it's, well, so which is it? You know something about the guy or you've never even heard of him. But that doesn't matter, right? And so he does this a lot. He sort of gives his supporters two options, and they are mutually exclusive if you're thinking logically. But if you're not, you can just sort of pick one, and either one makes the opponent look bad.
Well, and these kind of rallies are obviously playing to a base. They're not, you know, talking to undecided voters. People who are there to hear it are probably already decided on supporting the candidate that the president is stumping for. But how does this kind of message play perhaps outside of that core group of people who are going to support what the president says?
Well, that's a good question. The answer is probably that it is not terribly effective, but the second part of that answer is that it may not matter to the president. What he is looking for here is to hold this one specific seat with one slice of the electorate, and the broader view is not terribly important to him. And the thing I think that's important to keep in mind in this race, too, is that one of the reasons that he really wants Marsha Blackburn to win this race is that Blackburn is far more sympathetic to him than the current holder of the seat, who is, of course, Bob Corker. Mm-hmm. At one time, Corker was considered a potential running mate for Donald Trump. And then once Trump actually got into office, as we all know, Corker has become one of the most outspoken critics of the president within the Republican Party. So the president is eager to get Corker out the door and to get somebody like Blackburn in his place.
So as you said, some Republicans, pretty substantial Republicans like Bob Bob Corker, have distanced themselves from President Trump. Those are sitting Republicans. There are also Republican candidates who are choosing to kind of keep the president a little arm's distance. How is it breaking down who decides to encourage support from President Trump and welcome that, and who kind of backs off a little bit?
It's very state by state, isn't it? And you're right. You see a real spread of different strategies across the country. And a lot of it has to do with just looking back at 2016 and how did the president fare in each of those states. And you see this trend where in states where the president won big, in some cases, Republicans in primaries recently, we've seen them sort of elbowing each other out of the way to each claim that he or she is the biggest Trump fan on planet Earth. You've seen people with their campaign ads where they're wearing their Make America Great Again hats. And then there are other states where the president didn't fare nearly as well, and they're not running that way at all. In fact, they are very noticeably keeping a distance from the president. A terrific example, and a high-profile one, of course, is Mitt Romney's bid for a Senate seat in Utah. Utah, as we know, is a very red state, but not a red state that likes this president very much. In fact, he fared very poorly there during the Republican primary in 2016. And so you had this striking moment just a couple of days ago with Romney on the campaign trail, sort of coaxing his crowd to give a round of applause to journalists who were covering the event and talking about his love and respect for the First Amendment, just about the most opposite thing someone could do at a campaign rally from what you see Donald Trump do at his rallies.
So, Callum, you and your team at The Fix have pointed to four races that could shift power in the Senate. Which races are those?
Well, one is, of course, that Tennessee race that we were talking about earlier. And if Democrats were to win that one, I think that would be a huge, significant shift for the landscape, because you got to remember that the Democrats are hoping to take over really both houses of Congress this year if they could. And that would set up a really difficult fight potentially for the president heading into 2020.
And we're talking about ways that the Senate can shift. Are there states where Democrats are vulnerable that Republicans might be able to even out some of those losses they might be facing?
Well, West Virginia is one that comes to mind right away. And, of course, Joe Manchin, the Democrat, is trying to hold on to a Senate seat there. And he is sort of a unique Democrat in some ways, because he is someone who has not been the forceful critic of President Trump that you've seen other members of his party be. In fact, I can remember a distinct moment at a roundtable discussion at the White House just a couple of months ago talking about gun control, and Joe Manchin sort of heaping praise on the president during that televised event. And you've seen him. He's one of the few Democrats who's willing to appear regularly on Fox News. And so that is a state that would be perhaps inclined to go red. Manchin is kind of, I guess, what you'd call a purple Democrat as is. But Republicans see that as a potential vulnerability where they could turn maybe a sympathetic Democrat into a more zealous pro-Trump Republican.
And before we move on to other topics, Callum, you know, we're about 5 months out from the midterm elections, away from the general election. What are you and your team at The Fix going to be watching for as these races progress?
I think what we're looking for is indicators that might look ahead to what we can predict in 2020. And it sounds early already, and yet these races seem to, these election cycles seem to start earlier and earlier every 4 years. And I think that what we're all trying to get a sense of in 2018 is just how big of a difference, if any, do we see from 2016 as a foreshadowing. It's typical that the party in power will lose some seats in the midterm. You've seen the president talk about this a lot when he's out in public. He talks to his supporters about fighting complacency, as he puts it. He says that the party in power, especially the one that holds the White House, tends to lose their enthusiasm. He very badly wants his supporters to not let that happen. And so I think that's one of the things that we're really keeping an eye on. Is the president able to sort of keep the faith among his base and get them to turn out in a midterm election when perhaps history suggests that they will stay home and allow Democrats to make gains?
Kellen Borchers is a reporter covering the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. He's with us for our weekly look at some of the biggest national political stories. And Kellen, let's move on to the Russia investigation. The Russia investigation has been underway for about a year now. There have been some arrests made of former Trump campaign officials. Where are we right now with the investigation? What seems to be the focus at this point?
At the moment, the focus appears to be more on obstruction of justice, or the possibility that the president obstructed justice after becoming president. That's not to say that he has been, or his campaign has been, exonerated of any collusion, much as he loves to say that over and over again. There's no collusion, there's no collusion. We don't know that for certain. In fact, there are indicators that there was at least a willingness to collude. The biggest evidence of that, of course, is Donald Trump Jr. Taking that meeting at Trump Tower in 2016 with a lawyer who he believed was a Russian official who was bringing dirt on Hillary Clinton. But much of the recent reporting from our newsroom and others is that Robert Mueller's team is really zeroing in on the way the president conducted himself in office and whether he was, in fact, trying to disrupt the investigation at a level that would rise to obstruction of justice.
And President Trump tweeted today about his frustration with the ongoing investigation. That's nothing new, but he did specifically talk about his irritation with Attorney General Jeff Sessions' recusal after his appointment. And apparently he tried to convince Jeff Sessions to still oversee the investigation even after that recusal.
Yeah, that was a pretty good scoop by the New York Times last evening, and the president essentially confirming it with his own on-the-record comments about Sessions, who he has said many times before disappointed him by recusing himself from that probe. And, you know, objectively, it's just hard to understand that critique, because Jeff Sessions very clearly would have had at least the appearance of a conflict of interest there. He was a member of the Trump campaign team, a prominent surrogate on the president's behalf. It would have been very difficult for him to at some point deliver the findings of that probe and appear to have been impartial. And yet the president seems to believe that the attorney general ought to be his kind of shield. And he has talked about that over and over again.
House Oversight Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy, a Republican, said yesterday that he was more convinced than ever that the FBI has handled the investigation appropriately. It seems that in some ways, at least, more Republicans are siding with or defending the Mueller investigation and his team. Do you see that as having any impact in how the president and his administration moves forward?
Well, it's hard to say, because Gowdy, like Bob Corker, who we were talking about a moment ago, like Jeff Flake, these are Republicans who, yes, they're being outspoken, but they're also on their way out the door. There are a lot of these Republicans who seem, once they've decided to leave office, liberated to speak their minds about the president. What is a little bit rarer is a Republican who is seeking re-election or who is trying to hold on to power, standing up for the integrity of the investigation. We heard a little bit of that from Mitch McConnell a couple of weeks ago when he said that he supports both investigations, in other words, both the Robert Mueller investigation and the Department of Justice's Inspector General probe, which is looking at how the FBI conducted its investigations during the 2016 campaign. But that was sort of tepid support, and he, like other Republicans in Congress, have been unwilling to support any legislation that would actually protect Robert Mueller from being fired.
We're talking with Kellen Borchers right now. He's a reporter covering the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. He's with us to talk about the latest in national politics. After the break, we'll take a look at the latest on the possibility of a U.S.-North Korea summit. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Do you think the North Korea summit is going to happen? And do you think it's helping or hurting the United States that the meeting is in limbo? What do you think of the president's diplomatic strategy as it applies to North Korea? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, we continue our conversation about the latest in national politics with Callum Borchers. He's a reporter who covers the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the on-again, off-again summit with North Korea? What would you like to see come out of that summit if and when it happens? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. So, Callum, what is the latest update on, as we said, this very on-again, off-again U.S.-North Korea summit?
I don't know. Check the president's Twitter feed, because that's where the news is coming in. It's been really striking to watch the president kind of act as a one-man news service, which is, I think, what he has always wanted in some ways as far as the way he is covered. You saw this unfolding just yesterday when he was the one to confirm that Kim Jong-chol, the high-ranking North Korean official, was in Beijing and bound for New York to talk about the summit. And the reality is that the president is uniquely positioned as an authoritative source on this matter. It's not a case like we see in some other instances where he just makes assertions that may not be true and they can't change by his own words. In this case, if the president says, yep, I'm willing to take the meeting, well, then it's probably going to happen, unless, of course, Kim Jong-un decides to back out. And so what you have here is the president's sort of emotional vacillation on whether he wants to do this or not really are the story itself. And right now, he seems pretty determined to make it happen.
One of the things that I have found interesting is that after that letter that President Trump sent to Kim Jong-un last week saying, you know, I'm calling this off, you're too angry, there's too much hatred coming at us, I expected a fairly strong reaction from the North Korean side, and it doesn't seem like there was one.
That's right. And this is part of the president's strategy, or at least his claim that it's a strategy, which is I am going to be really aggressive. And that is the only type of rhetoric that a dictator like Kim Jong-un understands and respects. And he believes, the president believes, that that is the way to win this negotiation. That's what he said was behind the little rocket man name calling that he was doing. That was behind the threat last year to wipe North Korea off the face of the earth. I mean, that kind of saber rattling that sort of frightened a lot of other observers, in the president's estimation, is exactly what he needs. And on some level, it appears to be having some effect, because as you said, Judith, the North Koreans did not react with hostility the way one might have expected. In fact, they, if anything, seemed to become a little bit more conciliatory. And this meeting that was called off now looks like it could happen again.
And in preparation for that, as you said, Callum, Kim Jong-chol is on his way to New York. Who is he going to be meeting with?
Well, as we believe, he will be meeting with Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and that is a significant development on its own. Keep in mind that Pompeo has really played a really important role in these negotiations even before he was the Secretary of State, when he was the CIA director. He took at the time, secret mission to North Korea to begin laying the groundwork for these talks, and that was later held up during his confirmation proceedings as a reason that he ought to be confirmed. Essentially, he was already doing the job to some degree. And so that is a significant development. And what I think you see is a president who believes that denuclearizing the North Korean peninsula, the entire Korean peninsula, rather, or at least getting close, would be a major boost for his legacy. Again, I think in some ways it comes back to looking ahead to 2020. And I think he's aware that people will be willing, voters will be willing to overlook a lot. They will overlook perhaps his coarse rhetoric. They will overlook his inability so far to build the border wall that he promised, or to repeal Obamacare the way he promised, if he can have a signature achievement like a major agreement with North Korea.
And before we move on to another topic, Callum, briefly, where is South Korea in all of this?
Well, they seem to be somewhat sidelined, Judith. Recall last week we saw, or a couple weeks ago, when the president called off the meeting with North Korea, South Korea was blindsided by that development. And they seem still to be eager to have North Korea and the United States get together and willing to facilitate that in some role. But it's hard to imagine that South Korea is not feeling a little bit marginalized through the process, or at least a little pushed out of the loop. And I think that's one of the sort of subplots for us all to keep in mind here, is that is the United States going to damage its relationship, which has historically been very good with South Korea, in the process of its effort to reach better terms with North Korea?
And finally, Callum, Roseanne Barr sent a series of racially charged tweets targeting a former Obama administration official, Valerie Jarrett. She caught a lot of flack and very quickly for the tweets. She has apologized kind of, sort of, and blamed Ambien for the tweets. The criticism culminated in not only the cancellation of the very successful reboot of her show Roseanne, she was also dropped by her talent agency. Streaming services are pulling reruns of the original Roseanne. What's the response in Washington to all of this?
Well, I think the thing that we're all struck by today is the president's reaction, which was kind of delayed yesterday when the president was flying aboard Air Force One to Nashville for that rally. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, was asked about the president's response, and she said over and over, he doesn't have one. He's got more important things to worry about. He's working on North Korea. He doesn't spend his time talking about those things. And, of course, he didn't bring up Roseanne at his rally last night. But he couldn't quite help himself. He just had to get on the action on Twitter today. And what he had to say, of course, was about himself. He was not condemning what Roseanne said or even criticizing ABC for yanking her show. He was upset that if ABC was going to apologize to Valerie Jarrett, why haven't they apologized to me for all the terrible things that have been said about me, Donald Trump, on ABC's air?
Well, and do we know what he's referring to specifically?
It was unclear based on the tweet, but we did get some clues in today's media briefing. Sanders was talking about this with reporters, and she did list a few items that could be what he was talking about. For example, she was upset that Joy Behar, one of the hosts of The View, had criticized the president very sharply, I think called him a racist, that Kathy Griffin, the comedian, had done the same thing, and she was upset. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was upset that Griffin had been given a platform by ABC at all, after taking that memorable photo in which she had the mask of President Trump that appeared to be a bloodied, severed head.
Well, Callum, thanks as always for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Callum Borchers is a reporter covering the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. He joined us for our weekly look at some of the top national news stories. We will be taking your calls tomorrow after 4 about the cancellation of Roseanne. Be sure to join us and give us your thoughts. 2017 marked one of the Wisconsin's worst years for Lyme disease, and it comes as the state has seen a big spike in cases of the disease over the last decade. As researchers gear up for this year's tick season, we're going to take a closer look at what goes into tick population estimates, as well as what might be behind the state's trends. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. His recent piece for the site is titled, "Wisconsin's Annual Lyme Disease Forecast is Not a Simple Matter." Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
We just said that last year was one of the worst years for Lyme disease in Wisconsin. How bad was it?
Well, according to the State Department of Health Services, there was a 22% jump in cases, confirmed cases, between 2016 and 2017. Of course, that's from one year to the next. And when you're looking at a trend in public health, you want to try to keep it in a more long-term picture, but it's still, you know, in line with the increase that the state has been seeing over the years.
So you said that researchers do tend to look at trends over multiple years instead of one single year. Why is that? Is it just that one year can be an outlier?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's always the danger there of making too much of a short-term variation versus kind of looking at where things are going in the long run.
But we have seen a pretty dramatic increase in the last decade and overall trend since the 1990s of rising cases.
That's correct.
And I want to go back to something you said, because you said confirmed cases. And so what's the difference between confirmed and probable cases of Lyme disease, and why is that important to know?
Okay, so in the parlance of public health, when you know, government officials and healthcare providers and so forth are working together to track a given disease, you know, there's a few different kind of categories they put cases into. You know, a confirmed case of Lyme disease is, you know, where someone has taken a blood sample and actually, you know, tested it for the presence of the bacteria that caused Lyme disease. So it's like a lab confirmed sample, you know, and there's a lot of cases reported that are more just kind of diagnosed as people, you know, come in and their doctor sees that they have, you know, telltale symptoms like the rash that a lot of people with Lyme disease get. And the doctor, you know, reasonably so kind of says, OK, well, let's just get you on treatment. We know what this is. We don't necessarily need to take the time to do a blood test and so forth. And, you know, public health officials around the state understand that. And, of course, there's also, you know, statistical methods that are used to kind of project what the overall picture was from what they do know.
It seems like an important point to make that while they can certainly be closely connected, a big year for ticks may not necessarily be a big year for Lyme disease. You talk in your article about some human factors that can affect that. There might be a lot of ticks, but people are not getting infected as often.
Right. And of course, you know, getting a tick on you that will pass on Lyme disease that it's picked up from something else that's fed on previously. You know, the deer tick, also known as black-legged tick. That's obviously how most people are getting Lyme disease. But there's so many factors that influence Lyme disease. Obviously, there have to be ticks out and about and getting onto people for there to be cases of Lyme disease. But it can also be affected by just, you know, how much time people are spending out in kind of, you know, woody type areas that that are likely to be good tick habitat. You know, so even if there is not an explosion in the population of ticks from one year to the next, if more people are coming to where the ticks are at, that can certainly drive it up.
Or aren't. You talked about, you know, if it's a particularly rainy summer and people aren't out hiking or aren't spending as much time in their gardens, the ticks might be out there, but the people aren't there.
Right. And, you know, people get exposed when they're hiking. They can get exposed if they have, you know, some woods on their property. You know, a lot of people are exposed to Lyme disease fairly close to home.
One of the trends about Lyme disease in Wisconsin is the geographic location of cases that are being reported, and you report that it does seem to be moving. What directions are we seeing that?
Well, northern and western Wisconsin have generally gotten the brunt of it, and that's still the case, but ticks are generally understood, the deer ticks are generally understood to be spreading, you know, south and east across the state, you know, to the point where you basically see the ticks and the disease in every county. So, you know, perhaps it's reaching more of a saturation point where in Michigan, for instance, the spreading is still kind of happening. Mm.
It also makes you wonder, because of what you were talking about confirmed cases versus probable cases, you know, I wonder if partly there's more awareness of Lyme disease. And so maybe people are tuning in more and saying, oh, wait, you know, maybe this is Lyme disease, as opposed to, oh, I just feel really kind of horrible and, you know, achy and stuff like that. So could it possibly be one of those factors that we're seeing more cases, is there's more awareness?
Yeah, that's absolutely a factor to it.
We're talking with Scott Gordon right now. He's associate editor for wiskcontext.org, and he's with us talking about recent reporting that they did on Lyme disease research here in Wisconsin. And Scott, you talked to a few people about why there would be such a spike in Lyme disease, and none of them really had a clear, simple answer for you. What's your sense after talking to so many people about why the explanation might be so hard to pin down?
Well, it's so hard to pin down because there are so many things that go into the spread of the disease and people getting impacted by the disease. You know, of course, we mentioned the general health of the tick population and how well they're doing and where they emerge and sort of how the timing of their life cycles plays out. That can be a big factor. You know, also the health of other animals that the ticks feed on is a big one. You know, as the name deer ticks implies, they feed on deer a lot. They don't necessarily pick up Lyme disease from deer, but there are rodents that they feed on, especially in the northern United States, that tend to be what's known as good reservoirs for Lyme disease. And so the health, for example, of the population of white-footed mice is a really big one. And again, you know, human behavior and, you know, how different strains of the disease might be behaving, because there's more than one species of bacteria that cause Lyme disease, for instance. You know, that's all a factor, you know. So if we had a year where ticks emerged late, that would be a factor and so forth.
And you mentioned like the host animals. So it feels like this is a tremendously complicated web of players and factors. It almost seems like it would be hard for all the factors to come together in the right way for there to be this big increase. And yet we are seeing a significant increase, aren't we?
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of evidence that climate change is sort of helping tick populations spread out around North America, for example. You know, of course, they need, you know, fairly warm habitat for their life cycle to play out. So that's definitely a factor.
So needing a warm environment would seem to indicate that Wisconsin shouldn't be the tick and Lyme disease hotspot that it really is. What is it about Wisconsin that has been a really good habitat for these ticks and for this disease?
Yeah, I mean the ticks do, you know, hide out and survive during the winter, during part of their life cycle. They have a, you know, a 2-year kind of 3-stage life cycle and feed throughout that at each different stage. So, you know, usually either the larvae or the nymph stage tick will feed on something that is carrying Lyme disease and then pass it on to the next animal or person that it feeds on. You know, it's hot, it's humid. There's lots of densely wooded and brushy areas, lots of rodents and deer and other mammals to feed on. Ticks also feed on, you know, birds and reptiles. Obviously, reptiles are a bigger food source for them in the southern United States, but they're still part of the picture up here. So, you know, and, you know, as our climate gets, it's warmer, even warmer and wetter here, you know, they'll likely continue to be a big factor.
You say in your article that trying to forecast the population of seasonal ticks can be a, quote, slippery practice. Why is that particularly hard to calculate?
Well, because of all these different factors that we've been discussing and because of, you know, how all those different factors interact. And, I mean, you know, for example, the way that weather plays into all this, if there's, you know, some kind of midsummer drought, that could affect the tick population. You know, they need kind of moisture from the atmosphere to survive. You know, or if just some other unpredictable factor mm-hmm. like that could, you know, could sort of change the whole trajectory of it.
It sounds like it's in some ways similar to trying to predict agricultural seasons, because there are some things that you can pretty much figure out and count on, and then there are things that just kind of come out of nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially the way that weather plays into it.
So that having been said, that it's hard to predict, what did researchers tell you they're thinking this year might bring?
Well, I mean, given the long-term increasing trend of Lyme disease and the fact that it seems to have, you know, kind of spread out across the state, I think they're still concerned that it's going to be a big year for Lyme disease. You know, I haven't yet been able to follow up and find out what they make of this kind of really hot stretch we've been having and how that might affect the whole picture. You know, of course, there's a little bit of speculation that, well, because we had kind of this wintry weather up through April, would that delay the emergence of the ticks? And yeah, I mean, we still don't know, but we know that it's going to be an ongoing concern.
And Scott, as we wrap up, you know, it's concerning that there is this increase, that it's spreading across the state. The researchers you spoke with, did they offer, you know, kind of best ideas for protecting ourselves from Lyme disease?
Sure. Yeah. And it's the pretty standard stuff that public health folks put out there every year, you know, avoiding tick habitat, checking yourself for ticks after you've been out somewhere where you might encounter them, you know, obviously wearing pants and sleeves that cover your skin when you're out in that kind of habitat. You know, really pushing those basic messages is actually like very important to public health folks, even people who study things on a really specific granular level.
Well, Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That was Scott Gordon, associate editor for wiscontext.org. He was with us to talk about Lyme disease research in Wisconsin. You can read more about their work on ticks and tick diseases by visiting wiscontext.org/ticks. Even if the stories told as story catchers aren't exactly your own, they're entertaining, funny, heartfelt, eye-opening, and you can make you remember your humanness. Stories like getting into the wrong car in the parking lot on a day when your mind is too occupied, or maybe hiding drug paraphernalia from the cops in the world's largest container of cashews, and stories about times of feeling hopeless and alone in the world. Tara Polcuddy is the founder of Story Catchers, a community organization that hosts live storytelling events and teaches community members how to tell their stories. Tara is a published poet, author, and award-winning blogger. Tara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what led you to start Story Catchers?
You know, this is always a obvious place to start, and it's always my hardest kind of part of it because I feel like it's a lifetime that has led me to it. But as I kind of went through my own writing journey, I was approached more and more by people that would just say, oh, you know, if I were a writer, this is the story that I would tell, you know, as if there's somehow this magic thing that happens that only some people can tell their stories. And, you know, and people would tell me just these amazing antidotes or things that happened. And I'm actually working on writing my grandparents' story, and I set up a recording just off my garage band, my computer, to get some of the answers that my grandma was giving me so that I would have them to kind of look back to. And the stories that she was telling were so amazing. And I just, you know, kind of started this thought process of, like, if my grandma has these stories, and if all of these people kind of off of the street have these stories, like, how many more stories are we not kind of hearing from our community and really learning to connect to each other? So I started kind of reaching out to some of the people I knew through writing and some of that, just to see what the interest would be. And so for the first year in 2015, I held some writing retreats and did some pop-up recording booths at things like Mile of Music here in Appleton, and started the ball rolling. And then in 2016, in April, we had our first live event, and I had no idea what we were getting into or the stories we had, and I was just floored by 13 storytellers who got up to tell, and at the community who came out. I think that first one, there were still 70 people who packed in an art gallery, The Draw, here in Appleton, and we had no idea what to expect, all of us together, and it turned out to be really this amazing thing. And now we're 25 live events later, and we're still rolling.
Well, and I want to share a clip that you shared with us from that first ever live event. This story is told by Sherry. She had never done anything like this before. Let's take a listen to that.
I've had a lot of jobs in my life, but probably the most unique job I ever had was in a small town called Algoma, Wisconsin, and now, I was the oldest of seven, and we lived on a small dairy farm, and when I announced to my parents that I did want to pursue a four-year degree, I knew they would not be able to help me financially. But I was a farm girl, very ambitious, and I had a lot of jobs over my years to finance my college education.
All right, we're having a little trouble with that, but so Sherry had, what we missed was that her job was in a toilet seat factory,
yeah.
And she shared this with an audience of strangers and got laughs. What did Sherry share with you after doing that, what that experience was like?
Well, Sherry has become one of our regulars, and I'm so thankful for that, because not only does she have toilet bowl factory experience, as all of your good friends should, she, you know, grew up on a farm and went through all this Catholic school and has great nun stories and all of that. But, you know, again, it's just this, she shared, and I think all of us have these kind of random things that you think you've happened in the past or that have no context to anybody. You realize you have unique life experiences that have brought you somewhere. And, it's such a fun thing to have people kind of hold these stories and laugh along with you, something that you probably couldn't laugh at the time. Mm-hmm. But with some years behind you, you know, you're like, oh, I can see that it's funny. And I won't ruin the whole story because it's one of my absolute favorites. But, it's a very I Love Lucy kind of thing of it, you know, all the toilet seats going down the line. And it was really with that story that I realized what we were going to do is it was going to work, because just how unique everybody's experiences were. I've never worked in a factory, but it didn't matter, because I've been on an assembly line in some other capacity, you know, like, mm-hmm. or where you feel like you can't keep up and you don't know what's happening and just, you know, like, so, and I think that's the draw of it, and is just how unique, but how relatable everybody's story is.
And I want to make sure we get to hear some more of these stories. One of the parts of your project is that you've been working with students in Appleton Central's alternative school program for at-risk teenagers this past semester. And you've been going in several times a week and working with them on writing and storytelling. How different is it working with young people?
You know, it's not different working with young people, except for the fact that young people are, I think, what I consider closer to the source. There's, they have a little bit more ability to expose themselves in a candid way that I think as grown-ups we've forgotten how to do. So if anything, it's refreshing. You get more honesty. But they're by far some of my favorite stories to capture and to give them a microphone, because that's the one thing that I will say is that we don't always give them an opportunity to be heard the way that we do into adulthood. So it's one of my favorite things we get to do.
And let's take a listen to Haley from their program.
Promises are meant to be kept. So why did I break my promises to my mother? I promised her that once she was released from the hospital, we would celebrate her birthday. We never got to celebrate it. She died 8 days later. I promised her that I wouldn't cry every night I'd miss her. I promised I wouldn't starve myself when I missed her cooking. I promised I wouldn't sing the song she used to sing to me. I promised I would take better care of myself. I promised I would be brave and strong. I made a promise to myself months before she died. I said to myself, looking into the mirror, Haley, if Mama dies, you'll die too. I promise.
Wow. Very powerful. I have to say, I lost my mother when I was in high school, so that really resonates with me. It had to be both really empowering and also pretty terrifying for Haley to share that deep an emotion.
Absolutely. And and for her, it was a process of a semester to get to build to be able to share that story. So even behind the scenes, there's this growth pattern of learning the power behind your own voice and your own story, and of not being afraid of that, but kind of walking into it. And she did a beautiful job, and I'm so excited that we get to share it.
And Terry, you have a couple upcoming events. What's going on this Saturday?
This Saturday, so if this is intriguing to you, I, as part of my artist in residency actually at the Appleton Public Library, I am doing an exhibit or a recording exhibit of the living libraries. So kind of with this concept that we all have libraries within us. And so you can come on out. We've got some time reserved from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. just to record your stories. And you're like, I don't know where I'm going to start. I don't know what story you would have. We have prompt books available, and I love interview styles. So, you know, bring out your mom and ask her those questions that you've always wanted to know, or your kids, and document them too. And we'll be there capturing all the stories of our community.
And just briefly, Tara, remind us where and when that's happening.
That is happening Saturday morning, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Appleton Public Library.
And so people can just come out. They don't need to sign up in advance or anything.
Yep.
Just show up and tell their stories.
Sign up in advance. Absolutely.
Great. And we'll also let people know that there's another Story Catchers Live event coming up on June 21st. That theme is Expect the Unexpected. Tara, thank you so much for joining us today. Really interesting.
Thank you.
That was Tara Polcutty. She's the founder of Story Catchers. It's a community organization that hosts live storytelling events and teaches community members how to tell their stories. You can find podcasts of the previous events and listen to those stories and get information about upcoming events at storycatcherscommunity.com. this week is the Scripps National Spelling Bee, and I have to tell you, I love watching it. 11 million kids in classrooms around the country started the school year with a chance to make it to the finals, but only 519 were able to spell their way to Washington, D.C. this week. And I'm proud to say 8 of them are from Wisconsin, and we're hoping that some of them, maybe all of them, will make the cut down to 50 that happens today. Well, I looked up what some of the words were that our Badger champs have successfully spelled so far in the competition. One spelled deflugula. It's a genus of protozoans related to amoeba. Also, there was roti. That seems fairly easy, but it's R-O-T-I, so it could maybe trip people up. It's a round, soft, flat, unleavened bread. Contemporaneous could be tricky. Lots of vowels in there that you have to get in the right order. That's meaning of the same time period. An eighth grader from Fitchburg spelled tympanum, and that is a thin membrane covering the hearing organ of an insect. Well, another one that was spelled correctly is grisaille. That's decoration in tones of a single color to produce a three-dimensional effect. Well, the finals start tomorrow morning, and the winner will be decided Friday. Best of luck to all our Wisconsin competitors. Just making it this far is an amazing achievement. Let's hope none of them suffer from Ichabod after. That's a word that a competitor from Thorpe, Wisconsin spelled correctly, and it means regret for departed glory. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.